Now, the story so far, I'm going to cover very quickly. It's all on this first page. And we're going to look at verse 1 and then the very last verse of chapter 1. Because in the first verse of Ruth chapter 1, it says, "In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And this was a spur to a family, a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife, whose name was Naomi, and two sons, to leave Bethlehem and to go to live for a while in the country of Moab." Now, don't worry too much about what goes on in between, but then we get to verse 22, just over the page. And after all sorts of things had happened, we find that Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied this time by Ruth, the Moabitess. Now, leaving home is one thing. Returning home is another. Because people assume that we will be the same person that went away. When Naomi got back, people obviously went out to see her, and word quickly got around that she was there, and they would say to her, "Naomi, we hardly recognized you," which is never a very good start for personal confidence. But Naomi didn't reassure everyone that she hadn't changed. In fact, quite the reverse. She said, "My name, Naomi," which means pleasant, things are going well, "doesn't suit me anymore." In fact, she felt that God, in those intervening years, had given her a bad hand. She said, "It's better that you call me Mara," which means bitter. And she did have a point. The three people closest to her had died since she left home. First her husband, and then both her sons. Now, if and when we choose to return home, we may be recognizable on the surface, hopefully. But while away, inevitably, events, people we've met, experiences, crises, relationships have changed us. And we may find that our folks at home don't always take account of that. But Naomi, when she returned, didn't come back by herself. In fact, as we saw right at the beginning of the last verse of chapter 1, she returned from Moab accompanied by Ruth, who was one of her daughters-in-law, a Moabitess. Now, that would have been very interesting for the welcome home party, because Ruth had chosen to stay loyal to Naomi. And it's worth looking again at the extraordinary promise that she had given to Naomi when she said that she would remain with her for the future. Have a look at verses 16 and 17. In the middle of verse 16, just back over the page, chapter 1, Ruth said this, "Where you go, Naomi, where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. And where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. And may the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you from me." Now, this is a story in four parts, four chapters. So we had to make sure that we knew the bones of chapter one. Now we're ready to break new ground. So we're into chapter 2. What is new? Well, right at the very start, we are introduced for the first time to Boaz. On a day like today especially, we might call him Big Boaz, to distinguish him from Little Boaz, who, as you may know, was born this time last Sunday, very happy event, to Susanna and Jago Wynne and Daisy. Before we get too sidetracked by our loving feelings towards Little Boaz and the rest of his family, let us read again verse 1. "Naomi had a relative on her husband's side from the clan of Elimelech, a man of standing, whose name was Boaz." And as we continue reading through the chapter, we find that the setting is very different. It's certainly very different from what we experience in London W1. It was about the fields. For city dwellers like many of us, we associate the country with time off, beautiful scenery, a slower pace of life. But for the people of Bethlehem, as with other rural areas, whatever the age, the fields signify back-breaking hard work, earning a living constantly at the mercy of the weather. And as, again, we read down the page, we find that Naomi begins to fade into the background. She is offering a bit of advice to Ruth every now and again, as mothers, and mothers-in-law, if they are very brave, are wont to do. But instead, the attention now is on Ruth and Boaz, who come across one another in the harvest fields of Bethlehem. And let me just tell you that this is far more than a gooey Old Testament version of When Harry Met Sally. In fact, the closer we get to Ruth and to Boaz, the more we begin to respect these two individuals, exceptional people. And exceptional because they behaved and they thought in stark contrast to the norms of the society in which they lived. The time of the judges was famous for lawlessness and violence, selfishness, godlessness. It's described at the end of the book of Judges that everybody did as he saw fit. So Boaz and Ruth were not just a great couple. Independently, they stood out against the crowd because they cared more for the needs of other people than their own. And they trusted in the Lord rather than trusting in themselves. And we're going to see what that meant for them both in practice. Let's take Ruth first. Look at verse 2 again. Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, her mother-in-law, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." Naomi said, "That's a good idea. Go ahead, my daughter." And so Ruth went out and began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters. In other words, Ruth was taking the initiative for this family in which she now lived. Caring practically for older relatives is a very important but sacrificial task. Ruth could easily have claimed she hadn't had much of a life for herself. A mother-in-law, given her state of mind when she came back to Bethlehem, could hardly have been a bundle of fun. But Ruth had pledged her loyalty, and off she went to try and earn their keep. So she took on this responsibility. But as she did that, she became more and more conscious of her isolation, because her new neighbors couldn't forget that she was an immigrant. In verse 5, Boaz asked the foreman of his harvesters, "Whose young woman is that? Who is this woman who's appeared on the scene all of a sudden?" And the foreman replied, not by saying her name, but simply as, "She is the Moabitess, you know, the one who came back from Moab with Naomi." And Ruth was always aware of it herself. When we get to verse 10, we see that she was completely taken aback when somebody bothered to treat her as a real human being. And notice her, as she said, "Fancy noticing me, I'm a foreigner." Now, of course, governments today have a very tricky task, knowing how best to deal with large numbers of immigrants suddenly pouring into their countries. But I do have to say, it makes me very nervous whenever politicians get elected on a tough on immigration ticket. The fear is that people entering the country will not be seen and treated as human beings, with names, with needs, deserving understanding, consideration, justice, and dignity. And it helps us to look at the experience of Ruth. It was hard for her. How lonely she must have felt. But it's not necessarily because sometimes we feel a bit of a foreigner when we go to another country. There are other reasons why people experience isolation. Even tragically, it can be felt in a church setting. I want to give one example of that. Joanna Trollope is an author, and a few years ago now, she was interviewed by the Daily Telegraph. And in the article, she described herself as having, quotes, "a very quiet Orthodox Christianity, fairly regular at the local church." But she went through difficulties with her marriage. But she found very little sympathy for her at that stage. In fact, the harsh judgments and reactions she received made her feel, and I quote, that the church was full of comfortably complacent people who just couldn't understand. How lonely that can feel. Isolation and a sense of inferiority can go together. Ruth was very conscious that when it came to status, she was at the bottom of the pile. You know, the men went out and they cut the wheat and the barley and so on. And then behind them came the servant girls and they put everything into sheaves. And it was only behind that the people crawled on their hands and knees in order to glean what was left. And Ruth was conscious that when it came to status, she was at the bottom of this pile. She said, "I do not have the standing," she said to Boaz, "of one of your servant girls," in verse 13. Now, in one way, status in life is not an issue for those who know they've been adopted as one of God's own children. Because there's no greater privilege than that. But just as a human being, it must have exaggerated the sense of loneliness and isolation Ruth must have felt, this foreigner from Moab. And then, of course, she must have felt very vulnerable. Gleaning in the fields was accepted and safeguarded in God's law. Let me just read to you what it says in the book of Leviticus. When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Leave them for the poor and the alien. I am the Lord your God. Now, English people use the word glean for gathering little bits of information we're not told directly or formally. In the context here, we realize that there are many people in the world today still who live off other people's leftovers. But although it was a lawful thing for Ruth to be able to do, it was still risky. As a woman, she could have been molested by the men, or at least pushed aside and humiliated. And Naomi warned her later in verse 22. She said, "You must stay with those servant girls while you have the chance, because in somebody else's field, you might be harmed." Now, none of us can have our safety guaranteed, and we are unwise if we put ourselves at risk unnecessarily. But there are bound to be some who can only do their jobs properly, running risks every day. For example, journalists are constantly at risk. The plight of Alan Johnston and all the fears for his safety remind us of that. And there he was doing his job in Gaza in order to ensure that even the most dangerous situations are not hidden from the rest of the world. And just looking down to see what life was like for a stranger coming into a new culture, we realize that Ruth had so much to handle. Her responsibility to her mother-in-law in a brand new country, where she must have felt isolated, inferior, and vulnerable. And yet Ruth is a person who can remain focused on her work, dignified and humble in her relationships, and thankful for the small blessings that she received. Now, we'll be back with Ruth in a little while, but now we're going to change and have a look at Boaz, Big Boaz. And in this chapter, anyway, Boaz comes over as the man that every woman would like to meet. And every mother or mother-in-law, even, would like their daughter to marry. And he does come across, certainly from what we're told, that he was the perfect male specimen, treating women as they would really like to be treated. And in doing so, threatened every other male in the process. So not only was he a thoroughly nice guy, but verse 1 tells us that he was a man of standing. And therefore he was a respected member of the community. It may have meant that he had had a successful military background behind him. About that we can't be quite sure. But anyway, let's take a look at Boaz. How does he handle his relationships? Well, first of all, we consider him as an employer. Look in verse 3. The second half of the verse says, "As it turned out, Ruth found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was the clan of Elimelech." And as we read on in verse 4, it says that just then Boaz arrived from Bethlehem, and he greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you. The Lord bless you," they called back. You don't get that kind of response in every office on a Monday morning. But it just feels, as we read the passage, that he seemed to communicate well and easily with his managers and his employees. And later he's found sharing his lunch with them. He did have this mix of regular employees and also seasonal workers to deal with. Now, we know from our own experience in this country that seasonal, casual workers are an easy prey for the unscrupulous employer, as we saw with the cockle pickers in Morecambe Bay. And it is very encouraging, probably as a result of that kind of experience, to see new legislation for the farming communities, which gives clear rights to the casual labourers, many from abroad, and also clear duties to those who employ them, such as providing suitable accommodation. And Boaz seems to be a man at that time who was willing to keep in touch with his workers and is flexible enough to take notice of those who need particular attention. Quite a reminder to any of us here who manage other people that we'll do well to take our Christian attitudes into our place of work, not in order to compromise or soften our targets, but in order to treat those dependent on our people's skills and our moods with the care and respect that they need and deserve. But of course, Boaz wasn't only an employer, he was, as it turns out, a relative. And verse 1 has told us that Naomi had this relative. In fact, it was from her husband's side. But Ruth wasn't aware of that until she came home. And when she did come home at the end of the day, she was bombarded with a series of questions, as mothers like to do. In fact, it says in verse 19, her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." In other words, who was it? And when Ruth reveals it was a man called Boaz, Naomi was most interested. And she explained at the end of verse 20, "That man is our close relative. He is one of our kinsmen redeemers." In other words, Boaz, being a relative in that culture, would also have duties towards widows in the family. And we have to wait to see if he would take those seriously. But he wasn't just an employer, he wasn't just relative. He was a human being, a person. And as a person, quite simply, Boaz was extremely kind to Ruth. He goes further than the duty of being a good employer and kinsman redeemer. If you look down, you'll see in verses 8 to 9 that he was very protective of her. You look on to verse 11 and see that he was very appreciative of her. In the second part of verse 13, it's quite clear that Ruth saw him as a person who was both thoughtful and courteous. "You have given me comfort," she said, "and have spoken kindly to your servant." And then he was also very generous. In verse 15 and 16, as she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men, "Even if she gathers among the sheaves, don't embarrass her. Rather, put out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up, and don't rebuke her." And what a difference that kindness would have made to Ruth. I didn't finish the quote from Joanna Trollope from earlier on, when she was talking about the difficulties that she faced during the breakdown of her marriage. And she said, "I remember one Sunday kneeling in the church in absolutely uncontrollable tears, thinking, sadly, how do I get out of here? Then a farmer's son," she said, "who was sitting next to me, saw how distressed I was and leant very gently against me. It was a good job," she said, "he didn't do more, because I might easily have flung myself into his arms." In case we suspect that Boaz was kind to Ruth because he just had a soft spot for her, Naomi gives him a positive and general reference. She said in verse 20 about Boaz, "He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." Some years ago, I heard a vet speaking on television about this job. And he happened to say, and perhaps you've heard this before, but he said, "People don't care how much you know, but they do care. They do want to know how much you care." Now we've taken a look at these two people, Ruth and Boaz, and it's time to pause and ask a question. Here were two people. They were believing in God, going against the tide of unbelief, and they were showing all the signs of a maturity in their daily lives and relationships that leaves us quietly very impressed. And we ask, well, how did they do it? What was their secret? Now, to answer that, all we can do is to look back over the chapter again. This is our brief for this morning to find out. This is, after all, a story, and it's one bit of a story. We shouldn't expect crisp, tidy, comprehensive answers to questions like that. So without contriving anything that really isn't here in the passage, what do we notice? Well, certainly what I find extremely striking as missing is a level of support. Now, we almost take it for granted that our Christian community will provide networks and structures, training events and teaching sessions, Christian books on every subject under the sun, magazines, CDs, downloads, all kinds of music, pastoral care and counseling, conventions and quiet days, gatherings for prayer and groups for fellowship. Now, those are all good things. And I have no intention of knocking it at all. In any case, we live in a world where expectations have increased dramatically in every area of our lives, whether it's health or food or security or education or entertainment, the lot. And that is bound to be reflected in the way we set about our Christian business, given the nature of our contemporary culture and civilization. It's just that Ruth and Boaz lived without it. Now, again, we must be careful. They would not have been devoid of teaching. about the God of Israel, I'm sure, is very important. To know about his creation, his salvation, and his laws. And this would have been conscientiously handed down from one generation to the next. And both Ruth and Boaz will have heard all about this within their own families from their very youngest days. So no lack of teaching, but here was Ruth getting by, really on so very little in terms of encouragement and support. The message for us is not that we scrap all means of support, but perhaps we do actually ask ourselves, how much do I depend and rely on these things to keep me afloat? Should and if and when all these helps are taken away, how will I stand? That strikes me as missing, the support. But what strikes me as remarkable is their faith. And there is one verse here, perhaps you've noticed it particularly, which is extremely revealing. And this one verse is a commentary on everything else in the chapter, because it exposes the nature of their faith in God. And it's chapter 2 and verse 12. Boaz prays, chapter 2 and verse 12, "May the Lord repay you for what you've done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to take refuge." So Boaz and Ruth didn't only get together for lunch, they also got together for prayer. And when they did that, Boaz prayed. Word had got around, not just that there was a foreigner in town, but that she, Ruth, had sacrificed everything to stand by her mother-in-law. Before the prayer, Boaz says, "I've been told all about you. What you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. How you left your father and your mother and your homeland, and you came to live with a people you did not know before." So here was then Boaz praying that God would in turn shed his compassion, his kindness on Ruth, who had been so generous and sacrificial in her kindness, people like Naomi. And this prayer is an echo of Naomi's prayer that she prayed for both of daughters-in-law back in chapter 1. But see again how Boaz prayed. He said, "May the Lord repay you. May the Lord richly reward you." This was simple, natural, believing prayer. He prayed, and he prayed for God's kindness, not realizing that God's compassion was being exercised through him. In fact, God was answering Boaz's prayer through him. You may have noticed in verse 3 a little phrase here, which is quite important. It says that when she went into the fields behind the harvesters, as it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz. Now, very often as Christian people, we look back and we're seeing something that seemed perhaps quite by chance to begin with was actually a sign of God's love and graciousness towards us, as it turned out. And while Boaz was praying, Ruth was trusting. And Boaz knew the sacrifices Ruth had made. He also knew the trust that she had put in God. And he expressed this in his own prayer at the end of chapter of verse 12. "The God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." That again is simple, natural, believing trust. Ruth trusted in God's protection. In a way described here, which is fantastic picture language. It's like when the psalm writer cries out, "Keep me, Lord, as the apple of your eye. Hide me in the shadow of your wings." Now, Ruth had plenty to moan about if she had chosen to. She could have been like Naomi. Naomi blamed God in no uncertain terms. You don't need to look at it, but I'll tell you what she said. She said, "The Lord Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full. The Lord has brought me back empty. The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." And it is very tempting to look at God and say, of course, everything has gone wrong. And although different, it can also be tempting to look at God and say, of course, everything is going right. Quickly and publicly, we point to examples where God has evidently answered our prayers, while at the same time, silently and privately, we feel we must ignore the reality of the struggles that remain. And so there are people who might be inclined to say, God, everything's gone wrong. Or other people who persuade themselves, God, everything is fine. But Ruth wasn't saying either. She trusted in God's protection, not knowing the future. And the big clue to Ruth's constant faith was that it was unconditional. She was not trusting in God as long as he did this or that or iron this situation out or another. Many of us seek solutions to our problems. Sometimes they come, sometimes they don't. If Ruth wanted solution to her difficulties, she certainly didn't demand them. When she decided to stay with Naomi, sacrificing her own freedom, she could not know that it would work out in the end to her advantage. When she started working for Boaz, she had no idea that he was a relation who might care for her. And then we come to the very end of chapter 2. Ruth stayed close to the servant girls of Boaz to glean until the barley and the wheat harvests were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law. That's also all a bit of an anticlimax. In one way, it tells us nothing. But another, it speaks volumes about Ruth. Ruth trusted God fully. And she trusted him fully, not knowing what outcomes there might be. And then she simply went on with her work in the fields and supporting her mother-in-law.